You're listening to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. I'm Art Ray. Today, we'll be going to the archives to hear a presentation by Hugh Lynn Cayce. Hugh Lynn Cayce served his father's Association for Research and Enlightenment, the ARE, as chairman of the board before his death. He was also the author of the book Venture Inward, an examination of safe and unsafe methods of exploring personal psychic experiences, and The Outer Limits of Edgar Cayce's Power, which explores the relatively small number, 200, of readings that appeared to be inaccurate. You'll find many wonderful lectures in our online member-only section at edgarcayce.org/members.
I was sitting on a cot, an army cot, in a barracks at Fort George G. Meade, Maryland. A big army camp for training men for the Second World War that existed between Washington and Baltimore. And I was in basic training. That involved taking apart a carbine and putting it back together again. I had it apart on the bed. I was not sure that it was ever going back together again. Very simple mechanism, but I'm not really familiar with it. Since I was a Pisces, my army cot was right next to the shower room, as usual. This was in the afternoon, and the barracks was practically deserted. There were some people milling around, a couple of boys up at the far end of it, a big, long barracks with army cots on each side. Any of you may run into them, you know what it looks like. I began to hear a clop, 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 clop coming down the barracks room floor. The wooden clogs of somebody on the way to take a shower. As the noise got right opposite me, I had reached an impasse with the gun, and so I looked up. And here was a man, young man. He turned out to be 18 years old. I didn't know it at the time. Very young man. I was 30-something by then, and he seemed very, very young to me. He had only a smile on, and a towel over his arm, and a bar of soap, and these wooden clogs on his feet. And as he was opposite me, I looked up, and what possessed me, I do not know. But I said, I haven't seen you since we were caught stealing those camels in the Gobi Desert. He did a sort of second take and then marched on without a word into the shower and took a shower. And I sat there, but I was transfixed because what I had seen was a scene conjured in my mind. As I said that, of three boys, teenagers, around a little fire in the desert, and there were white racing camels nearby. In the distance, I could see people coming on camels, and I knew these were members of the family of all three of us. We were teenagers, and we had taken the family car without permission and had been racing these camels on the desert. And I knew without question that we were about to get one of the worst beatings of all of my incarnations. It was a strange terror, a fear of being whipped with canes, badly. Now, I had no question of whether I deserved it or not. There was no question about that in their minds. But this fear was there in a strange, possessive sort of way. Now, I did not talk to that young man for a year. He was in another platoon. I was pulled out to do some writing and didn't even get my basic, really. And joined the company, got back again. We went to Europe. And he came to me in England and gave me a copy, a beat-up copy of There's a River that was going around the company, and said, I'd like to talk to you about this sometime. And we didn't talk again for months, because we were at that point, it was 16 days after D-Day, and we were about to land on the Normandy coast with four trucks and, oh, several trucks, and a pianos, four pianos, and a complete band, the weirdest collection of stuff to invade Europe with you ever saw. Special service unit. That young man was one of the three best of our hypnotic subjects much later in that company. An amazing person. The other character in that scene I've found since then. For a few moments, let's look at one of the sources of fear, as Edgar Casey sees it, that is not in conformity with accepted psychological and psychiatric techniques. Now, I know and recognize that there are psychologists and psychiatrists even now who are considering this as a possibility of the causes of many deep-seated problems that man faces, and there are seminars that deal with hypnotic regression that you can go to and try to track down some of your problems. Not just fears, but other kind of problems. There are a few other problems other than fears, though it may not have sounded like it when I get through by this week. Let me talk about some approaches that are not educational, that for me lend credence, and that I'm constantly trying to balance the educational concepts against these other findings. Now, I don't know where you are in the reincarnation idea. Many of you may have accepted it when you were children. Many of you may think it's a bunch of hogwash, and you put up with it down here because we talk about it. And some of you may be in between, undecided. Unless you want to get very involved, don't bother with it. You can be in that same position of that man who walked around with this old clipping in his pocketbook for years, saying, I didn't believe in reincarnation when I was here last time. Don't bother about it if it bugs you, because the evidence for it, ladies and gentlemen, if you take the time to look, is overwhelming. It is overwhelming. If you've got brains enough to look at it, and the time and the diligence and the honesty to look it straight in the face. Because the reason you and I didn't like it when I ran into it in an Edgar Casey reading, 9 pages of the stuff that was handed me when I was 16 years old. And I'd been away from the family for a few months, and they had gotten into this trouble. And I thought my father had lost his marbles completely. And I began to try to disprove it. And the more I worked to disprove it, the stickier it got and the more difficult. And that has continued. Now, It's been my policy, therefore, to look in all the other places that I can find for parallels. Not just parallels of conviction or evidence for it, but parallels in terms of the laws that are involved. How does it work in our lives? That's what's important. Not who we were or where we were, but how do the laws work? Is it true that cause and effect, carrying over from one life to another, actually affects us in the detail, in the multitudinous detail that is suggested in the education material? Jesus just might have been right when he said, "What you sow, you reap."
We'll be right back with more with Hugh Lynn Casey on Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Casey. You're listening to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Casey. We're back with Hugh Lynn Casey.
Jesus just might have been right when he said, "What you sow, you reap." You meet nothing but yourself in this life. You have no problems but those you create in this life. There is nothing between you and God but yourself. An illusion. A rebelliousness. A refusal to accept responsibility. That's what it looks like. And that's sticky. You and I used to want, and some of us still do, I jump every once in a while, find somebody to hang this on. My parents, the devil, God, the Russians, anybody that's handy that I can lay it on. I'm sure that even my wife thinks that I try to lay a little bit on her once in a while. So where do you look for some parallels? Here's where I found a few, and I'd mention only four of them. There are many more. The first one I would refer you to is hard to get a hold of, but the books are in the library, however. And you might want to take a look at it, because it has in it a technique for reverie that is very useful and that I will refer to tomorrow in more detail. A technique for not hypnosis, but a reverie state in which you can recall some fascinating business, if that's the way you want to go. In this case, A.R. Martin, in Researches in Reincarnation, is the title of the book, and the author is Martin, A.R. Martin. It's not easy to get a hold of. Wisner might get you one. There are copies in the library, which you can borrow some on reference also. In this, he has a fascinating reverie that he took a young woman into. This woman simply could not abide, was afraid of cats. She couldn't touch them. She couldn't come near them. She would just have agony of getting close to, a regular phobia, a fear of touching or being in the presence of a cat. And she couldn't figure it out. Now, whether this be an imaginary thing that her mind concocted, or whether it was true, matters little to her, because when she had finished with this session, she bought a cat and worked with it, and it lived with her, and she enjoyed it and got over this fear. She was taken back to the time she, in a past, in her reverie, she saw a little girl, a little waif, in an Indian temple, big statues and all. And she was begging for food. and the priest came out. And he had told her, as she said, though, of course, the language was quite different, but she knew what he had said, had told her to stay away from there, that she had no right in the temple, begging in the temple. And she had come back again and again and again. This time, he stopped her and hypnotized her and told her to look at the statue of the cat that was right there near him. And the cat's eyes began to flame, she said. And she began to scream. And the cat seemed to become alive and reach out to claw. And she had run, she said, out of the temple, never gone back in fear of that cat. She got over that fear in that one go-through session. Now, you realize what you're talking about, don't you? That this is psychiatry in a modified form. This is Freud's talking out something, living through something that's buried. In this case, it was totally buried, and she claimed out of her past life at that point. She saw herself. She was that little girl in the Indian temple. Talking it out, being freed of it. There's a gentleman that worked for a number of years up here near Baltimore in one of the great psychiatric hospitals of this country. His name is Stanislaus Grof, M.D. And for a number of years, first in Europe and then over here, he had government grants to work with and experiment with massive doses of LSD for terminal cancer patients. Dr. Grof has spoken here and spoken for us on the West Coast. He's an MD that works experimentally in many directions. He has written several books. Unless you want to be upset, don't look at them. Because they're complicated, they're technical, and they deal with the visions that these people had under LSD sessions of dying in a multitude of different ways. The depth. Now, what they were afraid of that he worked with them with the LSD was death, dying. They were afraid to die. And case after case, when they had lived through a death scene, which was a horrible death scene, and described it and looked at it, they came out of it free of the dying experience, free of fear of death, which is a great freedom for many people at certain points in their lives. For example, one of them went through a scene of being stabbed with a stone knife while being held and stretched out on an altar, an Aztec altar in Central America. And the heart was to be cut out. It was a horrible death. And they were afraid of dying in this life. But once going through this, cleared up. Drugs. I did several years ago, an hour, 2 hour, I forget how long, show with Ruth Montgomery and Gina Seminara and Dick Septon, the hypnotist. I was writing on this book at the time planning for it, working on it. And he was to put on a demonstration of hypnosis. We were discussing for the whole hour, 2 hours. I think it was a 2 hour and they split it up into parts. All a discussion on reincarnation. He picked out from the audience, the hypnotist picked out from the audience two, a young man and a young woman. and he hypnotized them off stage, off the camera. You're not allowed to hypnotize on camera. And the reason for this, by the way, is that over in England several years ago, a man put on a demonstration of hypnosis and showed how to hypnotize, and people went to sleep all over England. And he had to go around and wake them all up. And so they're afraid of doing that anymore. This man took the boy back. And he wasn't looking for fear, but it was fascinating to me that they ran into both of the experiences that these people described on the air were fear experiences. I don't know whether it's because I was looking for some evidence or looking for, you know, interested in that approach, or it's the trauma of the memories that break through once the consciousness is released, because we try to push down negative memories. It's difficult, but we smother them and bury them quite thoroughly, even from another life, apparently. But this kid was a little Indian boy in what he saw and related in his regression. And he was being chased on a horse. And that is a rider, an army man in a blue uniform, was chasing him. And he was frightened because suddenly the man clubbed him and killed him. And he was running from him, and he was frightened. The girl, when she was regressed, was being stoned in Rome, of all places. Or that's what she thought it was, on the streets of a great city, ancient city, and was about to die. And the rocks were hitting her. Fear experience. Fascinating business, these memories that people, and the freedom that emerges sometimes from some of it. Now, the fourth one, and last one of these parallels, have to do with what is perhaps the best evidence for reincarnation in written form at the present time, in my understanding. This is Ian Stevenson's work, of course. Dr. Stevenson, a psychiatrist at the University of Virginia, and many of you may have heard about him, know about him, may perhaps have read his book, 20 Cases Suggestive of Reincarnation. He has some new ones out now that deal with language and out of the past that are very exciting and very interesting. He's been collecting cases from all over the world for a long time. And one of his cases in the 20 cases deals with a Tlingit Indian.
We'll be right back with more with Hugh Lynn Casey on Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Casey. You're listening to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Casey. We're back with Hugh Lynn Casey.
Tlingit Indians of Alaska believe in reincarnation. They think they brought it over with them from Asia, from some of the Buddhist teachings or something. Anyway, they believe in it. And this Derek Pitna is one of the Tlingit Indians up there who believed that he had been killed by another troublesome Indian tribe with a spear in a previous life. And he had experienced this, talked about it as a small child. Now, when Dr. Stevenson met him, he had only the written things that the family, the mother, had taken down when the child talked about this. Because they're interested in reincarnation, they record things that the kids say. We, most of us, shush them up and tell them, you know, you're wild and crazy and shut up. Somebody will think you're nuts. And we don't let them talk about it. But in certain cultures, this is encouraged, and they encouraged him, and he wrote it out quite a bit. But the strange thing about this was that he was afraid. His fear was of sharp instruments. He would not have a knife in the house, and a Tlingit Indian who wouldn't have a knife was a strange character. And when they put him in the army, and he refused and would not touch, and they put him in the barracks for it, and Stevenson has a record of this, he wouldn't practice bayonet practice. He wouldn't stick a knife on the end of his gun and stab things people with. He couldn't handle knives. And he wouldn't have them. He wouldn't let his kids play with them. He wouldn't have any sharp instruments of any kind. And it came out of this fear business of having been killed once with a spear, according to his childhood memories. Stevenson's book is filled with these cases of memory of children of previous lives. Now, turn to education. Here's a very interesting case, and I parallel it with some of the psychological notes in some of the literature, because psychologists have noted that small children who cannot talk are frequently frightened of one person, but other people they're not frightened of at all. And nobody seems to know exactly why. They're scared of this one. The people may look pretty much alike, but one person can't touch a small child and start screaming and hollering, and another one that looks pretty much like that same person can handle them with ease. And this is a psychological, there's a question, and the psychologists try to explain this with all kinds of, it's very interesting. What they try to explain it by is more complicated than reincarnation. But that's another story. The question that was brought to Ed Casey with a small child that could not speak was that the child was sheer panic and convulsions, frightened, crying, and then going into convulsions over a family friend who visited the family constantly and who is very close, a close friend of the father's. And he was always coming over. He was a buddy of his father's. And they did bowling together and they fished together. He was running by the house all the time. The child didn't have to do anything but see him coming, and he'd start screaming. He was a little boy, and he'd scream. And they couldn't figure this out because all the other friends and men, this was the only person that this boy screamed about, this child screamed about. And they want to know why. It's 2148-7, a very interesting case. Ed Casey said that he had a memory of him where he had been responsible for a considerable amount of suffering in a previous life. Deep in the unconscious of a child that is not able to verbalize yet. Interesting. I've got these cases all numbered. If you're interested in looking any of them up, I can give them to you. Here's one that got involved and is this time very frightened of anything having to do with spirits, with mediumship. They cannot abide and anything that appears to be a ghost, or they get involved with anything that looks like a ghost. They will hear about it. They won't go close to it, get near to it. And this came out of a life, according to him, where the entity was involved in the Canaanite times, back in the early areas of what is now Palestine, with someone who was a witch. And the family was involved with it, and there was fear involved with the curses that were involved. Crazy business, these strange fears that seem to come over out of previous life experiences. Here's one that I knew very well. A woman in Norfolk, one of two sisters, very close to our family. And she had a very decided problem with smothering. She couldn't get in a crowded elevator. She couldn't get in a small space of any kind. She didn't want to be without air. She needed space to breathe in. And any closed space, she would become panicky. Well, she had a life reading, and she did not ask about this at the time. But the cause of this, but everybody knew it, but she thought it was just, you know, something that happened to her as a child, and she was told in her reading that she had died near Fredericksburg, Virginia, in an Indian raid where she'd hidden in the root cellar where they put vegetables to preserve them, and that the Indians had burned the house down over top of her, and she'd smothered to death. And so she was going up to Fredericksburg to see if she could locate some records of herself up there. And she and her sister and friends went to Fredericksburg and stayed in a motel. And the first night they were there, the sister was horrified because she went through a horrible night with them. The woman woke up, her sister woke up, and this sister, who was afraid of smothering, was practically purple in the face. She was thrashing around on the bed. Her eyes were wide open, but she wasn't awake, and she was trying to get her breath. And the body was contorted, and she threw herself off of the bed onto the floor and just seemed to be smothering. And the sister slapped her and tried to bring her to, ran and got the friends, and fortunately the man grabbed a bucket of water and came back and sloshed it all over, and she woke up, came out of it. Well, she did ask Edgar when she got back, when they had an opportunity for another reading, what had happened, and he told her she was too close to the place where she had gone through this death in the past, and it brought it back. A strange business. Claustrophobia is the technical word for this, the fear of small, enclosed small places. Here are two cases of two women, and I picked just two. There are a lot more. And you remember, I have not left the men out in this. I've given you two cases already of childhood experiences that related to sexual problems with men. These two cases are women, and both of them came to Educasi with the problem of not being able to have intercourse. They simply could not bring themselves to it. One of them couldn't get married, didn't want to get married because of this, and it was a problem for both of them. One of them had a horror of it and a memory of fear and horror of it because of being raped many, many, many times in an Indian raid, and it had come back. The other one, a strange business, was afraid of breaking spiritual laws because she had taken vows of poverty, of chastity in the past, and they'd stuck too tightly into another life, and it had created a decided fear of this sexual activity which was against spiritual law. Completely different, but fears related to both of these. Perhaps one of the fascinating cases that you might find fascinating in the readings, because, and it did, it, for me, it was extremely fascinating because, again, it was a child that couldn't verbalize. It wasn't making up anything. This child, a little girl, was brought to education when she was 4 years old, and she had not begun to speak well at all, and she had this a kind of retardment based on fear. Any noise, any loud noise, would set her off crying, and she would start screaming and go into convulsions, and they couldn't figure it out, and she'd be asleep and would be wakened by a plane flying over or by something dropping on the floor. And this was during the war years, so a lot of planes flying over as we were practicing in this country. And they couldn't do anything with her, and the doctors could find nothing wrong with her physically.
We'll be right back with more with Hugh Lynn Casey on Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Casey. You're listening to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Casey. We're back with Hugh Lynn Casey.
Edgar Casey's reading indicated that she'd been killed in an air raid on the French coast and had come right back very quickly, out of a year, that she had come back. And it was a very bad experience. She was bombed in that and was a child, 12-year-old child, and died. And the noise of the falling, the bursting of the bombs and the planes over, and the whole thing was brought back to her by any kind of noise. He told him to sit by her, and this is one of the beautiful ways of working with fear that we will talk about some tomorrow, again, besides the reverie, to sit and talk to the child and to close up this unconscious, to talk to her as she was going to sleep, start before she was asleep and continue until she was asleep, very softly, and touching her while this was going on, and convey the closing of the doors of the unconscious of memory that were troubling her. And they did this, the mother and father alternately, and she's never had any problems since that time. Ida Roth came through with a fascinating... I mentioned her the other day, that the lady who developed Rothing. And she came through with a case of a very bad neck condition of a man. He couldn't move his head or his neck, and she was working on him, straightening him out. And remember, her Rothing techniques are very deep, and there is a shifting, structural changes, actually, that go on in the body. And he began as she was treating him. He was amazed, and she tells though this, wrote it out in detail for me. It sounded weirder than some of Dad's cases, but he saw his head off of his body. His head was chopped off in England, and he saw his head rolling away from his body. And it was horrifying for him, but that's where the neck problem came from, was this, his whole attitude toward this. And she freed this whole thing up. The neck began to develop beautifully, and she said she got wonderful results with him after he had gone through this. Whether he hallucinates this, you see, or whether it's real, the freedom that results is the thing that is so important for people to get hold of here. Let me share with you one more case. This is a personal thing that I worked with on the West Coast. It was a difficult individual. Another young man who did not want to have anything to do with women. And this is pretty drastic in these times, as some of you know. It leads to all sorts of complications. And he was just, he couldn't bring himself to have a date. He was 22 years old at the time, and he couldn't, he'd never had really a serious date. He was really tied up in knots over women. Now, we got back easily in long discussions and a little reverie work to the sex play. And to, like the first case I gave you the other day, very severe punishment from the parents and a lot of furor over it. In this case, it was with his sister. And the whole thing ended up in a complicated business because the father had punished the boy severely and then become interested in the sister himself. And there was incest, and it led to a divorce and a break and a terrible mess in the family, just a horrible mess. And out of all of this, this boy had come out of it with no, just abhorrence, and yet was locked up in himself over this. One day, in working with him on reverie, I let him go back a little bit into... And he began suddenly, in the most pitiful voice I have ever heard, to talk about seeing a scene in a colonial setting. He had on knee breeches, and he was walking back and forth, up and down a room. And he was clutching a letter, a written thing in his hand. And he was so sad.
Well, it's time for the Thought for the Day. And today's Thought for the Day will be read by Allison Ray, my wife. Well, hello.
Hi, how are you today?
Oh, good. And what's today's Thought for the Day?
Today's Thought for the Day is 1792-2. Hence, again, might that injunction be given the entity not to be too easily discouraged. Brace up, knowing what ye have believed and do believe, but know who is also the author of such. For life is real, life is earnest, and the grave is not the goal.
Wow. Well, what does that mean to you?
In this, he's reminding us, Mr. Casey's reminding us, that sometimes we're going to have challenges and we shouldn't just give up and walk away from it, that sometimes we have to, you know, stand up for ourselves and maybe do the things we don't necessarily think we want to do.
Oh, yes.
And I know that for me, sometimes if a challenge comes, I think, oh, well, the universe is just trying to tell me that I shouldn't be doing that. And sometimes I need somebody to remind me, well, sometimes you just have to face your trials and overcome them.
And yes, this says to not be too easily discouraged and to brace up. And I guess we just have to accept that we're going to see these obstacles and have to overcome them. And that we do that through belief.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And knowing what you believe in and why you believe what you believe.
Yes. Well, thank you for doing the Thought for the Day today.
Thank you. And individuals can actually go to edgarcasey.org and sign up to have the Thought for the Day delivered right to their mailbox by email.
That's all the time we have for the show today. Thanks for listening to the presentation by Hugh Lynn Casey. To find out more, go to the Members Only section at edgarcasey.org/members. Thanks also to Allison Ray for the Thought for the Day, and most of all to you, the listener. Thanks for listening to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Casey.